Dr. Allen, members of the clergy, and all of the members of this great convention, while I am deeply grateful for this opportunity to speak to you this afternoon, I must also say how sorry I am that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., my father-in-law, could not be with you this afternoon. Daddy King, as we affectionately call him, was faced with an impossible dilemma. He wanted to have the chance to speak to you while at the same time he wanted to accept the invitation by our friends in Eastern Europe for a long-awaited trip. Unfortunately, the trip to Hungary meant leaving Atlanta earlier this week, and so Dad asked me to attempt to replace him, which I cannot do. I certainly am not a minister. For those of you who wanted to hear Dad, I apologize for being a very poor substitute, but I'm sure you're glad to know that the church and the socialist-dominated countries of Eastern Europe is alive and well. One of the churches Dad will preach at, for example, is one that has been recently named for my husband. That is a church in Hungary, named for Martin Luther King Jr. And so it is good to know that even in countries where the form of government is radically different from ours, the good news of Christ is being spread. And now with Daddy King over there, it will be spread with even more vigor and enthusiasm. Your loss, therefore, is Hungary's gain. And with the new Southern Baptist theme of "Let the Church Be Bold in Mission Thrust," how can your president, Dr. Jimmy Allen, tell Daddy King he had to stay at home? If Dad were here, I'm sure that he would begin by reminding you of the events of past years. I believe he would want to focus our attention on what the church did and did not do during the early days of the human rights movement led by my husband. Because by looking at the past, we may be able to better understand our roles for the future. As we look back, particularly toward those hectic days of the late 50s and the 60s, we see that the white religious leaders of our nation were reluctant to get involved in what apparently was regarded as a political movement of the black church. Because of that hesitancy on the part of both the clergy and the laity of so many white churches, the movement my husband led was sustained almost entirely by the strength and spiritual vigor of the black churches. Even as late as 1963, more than 7 years after the bus boycott in Montgomery started, my husband not only was not supported by the white churches, he was criticized for trying too hard to bring the horrible evil of segregation to a head. And as a result, he wrote his famous letter from the Birmingham jail to the white clergymen of that city, reminding them of the great obligations we as Christians must face if we are to meet the challenges of Jesus Christ. And that, of course, is my message of this afternoon. That in the rush to bring the spiritual message of Christ to our brothers and sisters around the world, we must not forget that we have to care about their physical and mental needs as well. Martin Luther King Jr. was constantly reviewing this apparent clash between the traditional churches concerned with only the spiritual side of people's lives, as opposed to becoming totally involved with the social, political, and moral plight of our less fortunate brethren. Not taking a stand against injustice was, in my husband's view, siding with injustice, and that in itself was a blasphemy against the Lord himself. These are Martin Luther King Jr.'s own words, and I read, "The Christian ought always to be challenged by any protest against unfair treatment of the poor, for Christianity is itself such a protest." Nowhere expressed more eloquently than in Jesus' own words from Luke, 4th chapter and 18th verse. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." 5 years later, my husband was still troubled by the lack of support from the white churches. This is what he had to say at that point. And I quote, "In any realistic doctrine of man, we must be forever concerned about his physical and material well-being. When Jesus said that man cannot live by bread alone, he did not imply that men can live without bread. As Christians, we must think not only about mansions in the sky, but also about the slums and ghettos that cripple the human soul, not merely about streets in heaven flowing with milk and honey, but also about the millions of people in this world who go to bed hungry at night. Any religion that professes concern regarding the souls of men and fails to be concerned by social conditions that corrupt and economic conditions that cripple the soul is a do-nothing religion," said Martin Luther King Jr., "in need of new blood. Such a religion fails to realize that man is an animal having physical and material needs." I'm not here this afternoon to criticize anyone or any group for what did or did not happen years ago in Montgomery or Birmingham, or hundreds of towns and cities throughout our land where minorities stood up for their social and political rights. Many of these battles have been fought and won. There's nothing anyone can do today to help turn back the fire hoses in Birmingham or the cattle prods in Selma. We have won many of our civil and political rights. The conscience of America was finally stirred and injustices were corrected. Laws have been passed and enforced that now guarantee that all Americans should enjoy their civil and voting rights. But under the banner of human rights, there lies ahead a battle which rivals that of the 50s and 60s in its need for men and women of goodwill to join together in brotherhood and love to correct injustices. I'm speaking, of course, of the campaign to achieve economic rights for all citizens. It makes little difference that a black man can now eat at a public lunch counter if he or she does not have enough money to purchase a meal. It makes little sense to strive to achieve political rights if those new rights are not going to improve the economic plight of blacks and other minorities. Don't let there be any mistake about this campaign for equal economic opportunity. It is not a simple one. It will, in the final analysis, probably cost this country more than all the rest of the rights efforts combined, because when you're talking about economic rights, you are talking about asking those who have to share with those who have not. And that means people would have to give up more than they want to. That, as we all know, was not and is not going to be easy. The struggle for economic rights, which I have been engaged in as president of the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Social Change, is a long and difficult one. And it is probably one that will not end in my own lifetime. We are, in effect, trying to make up for generations of neglect, generations of poor or no education, generations of economic oppression and even exploitation, generations of tradition in which blacks were always expected to do more menial labor, always expected to take the least paying jobs, always expected to give way to whites. It will take extraordinary efforts to make up for those generations of misuse and neglect. But not to undertake them would only lead to further chaos and despair. Most specifically, the campaign for full economic rights is focusing its attention on the key issue of full employment, mainly because most of us believe that providing jobs is the key to breaking the grinding chain of poverty and despair in our country. We believe that the right to a job is a basic human right, equal important in importance to any civil right or any political right. If we are really serious about wanting to restore the moral fabric of our decaying cities, if we are really serious about wanting to do something about rebuilding our urban areas, if we are really serious about wanting to do something about inferior education, about inadequate health care, substandard housing, about rising crime, unsanitary and unsafe environments, about all the other ills of our inner cities, if we are really serious, then we will do whatever is necessary to put everyone to work. When a person has a job, when the head of the family can bring home a decent wage, then we can talk about bringing peace and stability and harmony and love to that family. And then to that neighborhood, and finally to that city. Having a job and paying for one's own living expenses is a matter of pride and dignity. Having a job restores a person's sense of his own worth. Having a job means that the other problems can be tackled and won. But not having a job breeds hopelessness and despair and frustration and anger and a loss of personal dignity. The specific action steps being taken to bring about full employment are not perhaps appropriate to this occasion to discuss. However, what I wanted this afternoon to spotlight is that there is a role today for all of us to play in improving the economic conditions of our neighbors. We cannot, I believe, talk about a spiritual awakening in America or anywhere else without understanding that we must awaken our own consciences to the needs of our brothers and sisters, to their physical needs as well as their spiritual needs. As I move around the country speaking to the issue of full employment, I point out that it really is not an economic or political issue, but it is a moral issue. If this country, the greatest ever created, cannot move toward a day when all of its citizens can enjoy some of the fruits of our bountiful economy, then when can it be done? Martin Luther King Jr. once said that as a nation, we cannot really be a free people until all of our people are free. I say to you this afternoon that as a nation, we cannot really become a great society until all of our people have a chance to share in that greatness. If some of you take my words as too critical or too political, I am sorry. I've come here to share with you my thoughts about the past and about the great future that lies ahead. The Southern Baptist Convention is on the verge of a momentous movement, one that will carry the message of Jesus Christ to many nations and to many peoples. My prayer is twofold, that your missionary zeal be successful and that the true meaning of Christ's social gospel will be understood and followed by all who hear the good news and believe. To many people, Martin Luther King Jr. is a symbol of love, a symbol of reconciliation, a symbol of hope for the downtrodden and oppressed. His message to us was to love our neighbor and to treat everyone as brothers and sisters in God's family. We who carry on his work in his name believe that while our efforts may not be completed in our own lifetimes, we must never stop trying to push back the barriers of discrimination, hatred, and suffering. And we must do it with love, the love that is at the very core of nonviolent social change. Jesus Christ's Sermon on the Mount showed us what is expected of each one of us as human beings. To do less than what is asked of us is to risk our own redemption. My husband gave his life so that future generations can enjoy peace and freedom and dignity and justice. We must keep alive the legacy of nonviolence. We must nurture the knowledge for our children and for their children, that love of neighbor can change the course of history. The challenge we as Christians face today is to continue to work to fulfill my husband's dream so that a day will come when all people can share together at our Lord's table. I urge all of you to keep my husband's words in mind as you seek to evangelize the world and to care for the needs of all of God's people. May your work be successful and your rewards bountiful, and may you and those you seek to minister to find great peace and love and the good news of Jesus Christ. Thank you, and God bless you.